Okay. Hello, everyone. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome two very special guests. We have Gail Piava, who is a home economics consultant with a master's degree in food and nutrition. For over 30 years, she has developed and tested recipes and styled food for movies, television commercials, print ads, and packaging for an extensive list of high-profile clients. In addition to offering a cookbook herself, The World of Wok Cookery, she has also collaborated on a half dozen other cookbooks. And Laura Piava is an award-winning certified professional photographer and graphic designer. She's the co-owner of the high-end wedding photography business, Natural Expressions Wedding Photography, and she primarily works as a wedding and commercial photographer. Laura also has Lyme disease. And when Laura struggled with how to eat healthy foods to improve her Lyme, it was her mother, Gail, who stepped in with her expertise to create delicious recipes that made it easy for Laura to eat in a way that nourished her body and helped her to reduce the inflammation caused by her Lyme. They are both here with us today to talk about their amazing book, Recipes for Repair, and how it can help anyone with chronic inflammation. So welcome, Gail and Laura. I'm so happy to have both of you here with us today.
Well, hi, Kelly, and thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Excellent. So I'm going to go through a couple of questions with Gail and Laura, and then after that we're going to open it up so that anybody can ask questions, anyone on the call, and they're going to tell us about some special offers they have for all of you health coaches, maybe during the questions or after the questions, whenever they sort of come up. So for those of us that are on the call who don't have a copy of the book yet, Laura, can you give us sort of just an overview of what the book is and what it offers?
Sure. The book is divided into three parts. The first part is specific to the an inflammation diet that was developed by Dr. Kenneth Singleton, who is a Lyme doctor, but the inflammation diet is specific to anyone who has any sort of inflammatory illness. So he really gets into what inflammation is, what causes it, how food can lead to chronic inflammation. He has a chronic inflammation self-assessment tool, and then he speaks about the diet and how to introduce the diet into your life. And then we also talk about refined foods and organic versus conventional and why you should eat organic foods. We also have some tips on how to save money when shopping organically. And then part two of the book, we get into cooking methods and useful cooking equipment so people who haven't yet, you know, who aren't really seasoned cooks can still benefit from this book. And we also have a food glossary because a lot of the foods in the recipes might be new to people, foods like quinoa or agave or sea vegetables, just some more non-traditional foods that we use in the book. Then we also speak about speak a little bit more about whole grains and nuts and how you should prepare your food. And then part three of the book then goes into all of the recipes. There's 150 recipes, and we have it divided by phases because the book is a four-phase, the diet is a four-phase diet. So we have phase one through phase four, and we have icons on each of the pages that indicate whether or not the recipes are gluten-free, dairy-free, egg-free, vegetarian or low sugar, so it really helps people who have known food sensitivities or allergies to be able to just quickly at a glance know whether or not this recipe is something that they should be eating.
Thank you. And this is why I love the book so much, because it has all of that. And I know there are people on the call right now thinking, wow, that's like all the work that I do in a book. But it really is an amazing book. And no, it won't take the place of health coaches, but it is a great, I found it to be a great resource and sort of a you know, a great thing that I can hand the client and say, okay, you know, you just found out your food sensitivities, which means you have inflammation here. You know, this will help explain it more than, you know, I just did, and this will help you on the path to how to eat now for your body. So thank you for sharing all of that. It's an amazing, amazing resource. So, Gail, this one's for you. Can you tell me a little bit about what you and Laura were hoping to achieve by creating this book and these recipes?
Sure. Laura, as you said, has Lyme disease, and she decided that when she found out that she has Lyme disease, that she first had to find a good doctor, and then she had to, after she found the doctor, she was up to her to educate herself to see what she could do for herself. So she read a lot of everything she could find, and she found Dr. Singleton's book, which is The Lyme Disease Solution. And in that book, he has a chapter that is on nutrition and is on his theory about eating an anti-inflammatory diet, and as she said, the four phases. So she wanted to try the diet because she felt maybe this is something she could do to help herself, because being somebody with Lyme, you can get very desperate because there isn't that much help out there, and you feel sort of that you have that who is going to help me, and if you can try and help yourself, it at least gives you a little bit of control. So she said, I want to try this diet, Mom, but I think I'm going to starve to death because the beginning is very, the first week is 1 week, the first phase, and it is restrictive. And so she said, I don't know what I would eat. So I said, well, send me the information, you know, what's in the, send me the list of ingredients. So she did, and I looked at it, and I said, well, there's plenty to eat on here. I'm sure that I could find some, give you some recipes. So I did. I went about, and I made up, you know, four or five recipes, sent them to her, and said, try these. So she tried them, and she said, wow, these are really good. So we continued on this vein. All right, we got through phase one, and now, okay, send me a list for phase two. And so she did, and I developed some recipes for her, and she said, you know, this is really not hard. This is not as hard as I thought it was going to be. Actually, these recipes taste good. And, you know, then she said, well, maybe we should, I wonder if this doctor would be interested in maybe doing a book, because you have, as Kelly told you, I'm a food stylist. I'm a recipe developer, and this is what I've been doing for 35 years. So I said, yeah, I could do that. And she said, well, you know, she has all the expertise to put the book together. So we wrote to Dr. Singleton, and he got back to us and said he was interested. And then I started thinking, well, this was really, it was a challenge, an incredible challenge for me, because even though I've been doing this for years, I've never had an audience of people who were sick, and people who, and they have every right to eat and have food that's just as tasty as a person who's not. So I thought, well, you know, that was my goal, make these recipes. Because you're sick doesn't mean you should not eat well and it should not taste good. So my idea was, I'm going to do recipes and I'm going to make them taste good and people are going to want to eat this food. And so that was the goal that I had set. And in doing that, I was able to help my daughter. And I thought, you know, I hear all these horrible stories that Laura tells me about people in her group, and nobody seems to be able to help them in a lot of different ways. And food is, everybody wants to eat. Everybody wants to eat well. Everybody wants to enjoy what they eat. And so I thought, well, if I could do a little bit to help, if I helped her and she liked them and I could help other people, I'd be thrilled to do it. And so that's how it started, and that's what we did.
That's amazing. And I just have to say, you know, for probably everybody on this call, Laura, you're so lucky.
I know I am.
Everyone's probably thinking, oh, if we just had a gal to, you know,
exactly,
come in and make those foods for us. And
exactly.
So that's amazing. And really, you know, I commend you, Gail, for doing that too, for stepping in and taking that on. So.
Yeah, and as I told you before, we're continuing on. We're doing more. And everything, I say, well, maybe I could try this. Maybe that would work. And when something worked, I really am thrilled, because I didn't know even what some of these ingredients were when we started. I was like, oh, and how can this be dairy-free? And
and white flour free and sugar free and still taste good. How can that be?
Okay.
And so I was amazed myself that some of these things, you know, that I really never tried, they just taste just as good to me. So and my food testers felt the same, which was very important.
That's amazing. So, Gail, tell me what some of the foods were, the key ingredients that you used in a lot of the recipes that actually help with inflammation, or what were the main things that you were leaving out, let's say?
Well, in the beginning, you know, as I said, things were the only protein in the first chapter, the first phase would be egg and would be fish, and just certain kinds of fish. But just, you know, okay, what are we going to have for breakfast now, you know? So we have a carrot almond pancake that it is a pancake, but there's nothing in it but carrots, almonds, some raw honey, and it stays together beautifully. It has an egg, which is a binder. It stays together beautifully, and it has a sweet taste, and it's just, it looks pretty, and it just is something that I never really consider. I always think if you have to have a pancake, it has to have flour in it, but no, it doesn't have to have flour in it. So, you know, we are, that was, you know, like the kind of thing that we were going for. Like we have the poached egg Florentine with a béarnaise sauce, and I thought, well, you know, maybe you would like to do a brunch, or, you know, you want to have something a little bit fancy. And so, I mean, a poached egg is really nothing. Florentine spinach is great for you. So there were many, many vegetables allowed. So we tried to get, you know, things in there that sounded like they were gourmet, which are really gourmet, but are really not that hard to do. And so, you know, in my mind, I thought, well, it should be something that's, doesn't take that much time. It should be something that, wow, that sounds good. And the pictures, wow, that looks pretty. Because I don't know if Laura mentioned there's a 51 color photos that we did. Laura's a photographer and I'm a food stylist. So we were able to, you know, I did all the propping and we were able to do the pictures that are, you know, and everything ourselves. So we figure that, I always figure that you eat with your eyes first. That if something looks beautiful and looks good, it's appealing, you'll want to try it. And that was really, really important in the phase one, especially because when you're first starting out, if you know, you think, oh, my God, all I can have is vegetables or whatever, if things look pretty, sound interesting, and then they're really good for you, you don't think about, oh, this is good for me. You think about, this looks good, this sounds good, this is pretty, so, you know, I'm interested in that, so... And so, you know, we had the list of foods from Dr. Singleton that were what he wanted you to be eating in the first phase, and that's how everything came about. You have this list of ingredients. We want to have these things that are, you know, that are good for an anti-inflammatory diet, and how do we do it? And so we tried to get we don't have all of the foods he has listed in the recipes because they're, you know, there aren't that many recipes in the first section, but we tried to use the things that we felt were, you know, the best for people. So that's really how we get into each phase does the same thing. It introduces new foods. We bring those into the recipes as much as we can. The rest of the foods that we got that are in there are what Dr. Singleton felt were appropriate for that phase.
Okay, great. And Laura, can you share with us a little bit about how, you know, eating those foods, or, you know, eating the foods contained in your mom's cookbook or the things she provided for you, how did that actually impact your inflammation or your condition?
Well, when I first started the diet, I was also simultaneously being tested for food sensitivities. So I found out that I was dairy sensitive, and that was the one that was the strongest sensitivity. So the doctor told me to stop eating dairy, which was a big shock to me because I love dairy. I used to drink a big glass of milk, like a pint of milk every day, and cheese on everything. And so to limit myself to foods without cheese was really a shock to my system. and also going through the diet, like my mom said, it's in phases. So he eliminates the foods that tend to cause inflammation in a person's body in the first few phases of the diet. So it was also, not only was I getting rid of dairy, which was something he was eliminating as well, and the doctor had told me to, I had also needed to eliminate anything containing gluten and the nightshade foods and other foods that were known to cause inflammation. So that's why I felt like I might starve to death, because I was so used to eating a diet that was rich in dairy and rich in carbohydrates. I didn't really eat like junk food or anything, but I definitely had carbs at every meal. I had a lot of bread in my diet, and so it was really a shock to my system to change, because I was so used to how I was eating. It's like you kind of get into that rut of going to the grocery store and going down the same aisles and picking out the same foods, and then to be told you can't do that anymore, it just was really overwhelming. And so when I did change my diet, I started to notice, and this was with time, because I think that people have the perception that if you have a food sensitivity, that it's the same as a food allergy, and that it's something that's really cause and effect. Like you eat a peanut and then you have an allergic reaction. But with mm-hmm. a sensitivity, it's not like that. You can eat something and have systemic inflammation, but you don't notice it, or you might not realize that what you ate caused something that's, you know, giving you a headache or something that doesn't seem like it's really a cause and effect. So mm-hmm. It was only over time that I realized that the change of my diet, which continues to be no dairy, no gluten, no soy, no corn, no white sugar, no refined flours, no processed food, that I no longer have feelings of hypoglycemia. In mm-hmm. the past, I would have problems where I would have eaten lunch or eaten breakfast and feeling fine, and then all of a sudden I'm just feeling like I'm getting a hot flash, and I'm feeling like I might pass out, and like this immediate need to eat, and if I don't eat something, you know, like I feel like I might faint. So as soon as I ate, everything was better. But now I realize that with the change of my diet, I don't ever feel like that anymore. And what really kind of brought that point home was over Christmas this year, I decided to splurge and to eat crackers and cheese and to eat, I don't think I ate cheese, but I ate crackers and I ate cheesecake. And sure enough, I had that same feeling of, oh no, like the hot flash and the really feeling faint, like the low blood sugar symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really pointed to the fact that what I was eating does really affect how I'm feeling. And something else that I've noticed is that I don't have cravings anymore. I used to crave a lot during the day, like as I would get hungry, I would crave something specific. But now that I'm eating differently, you know, like a lot of protein at every meal and just all whole foods and all organically, that I don't ever crave anything. I don't really ever feel hungry. So, you know, I'll eat breakfast at 8 or 9 o'clock, and then it could be 1 o'clock, and, you know, someone at work is eating lunch, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to eat lunch now. It's not like I have this immediate need to eat. I eat because I'm starting to get hungry, but it's a slow and gradual thing. And I've also noticed that I've lost a little bit of weight. I didn't need to lose weight because I'm a thin person as it is, but it seems that everybody has the weight that their body likes for them, and mine has always been very consistent. But when I changed my diet, I dropped about 10 pounds, and now I'm pretty much at that same point. And it's been over a year since I've changed my diet, and I could eat as much as I want, whenever I want. I just can't eat what I used to, and I stay consistent at this new weight. So it's pretty interesting.
That is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we try to tell people. Sometimes they listen and believe us.
But, I'm sure.
Well, that's excellent. That's really good. Excellent. This one I think I'm just going to direct. I only have two more questions, and then we'll open it up to the group. But the next question is really for both of you, so just mm-hmm. maybe one at a time. I'm just wondering, what else do you think that we as health coaches should really know about the connection between inflammation and food, and, you know, how to best support our clients who might be suffering with chronic inflammation or might not even know that they have chronic inflammation?
Do you want me to go first? Sure. I think that it's important. Well, I know that you were talking about testing, so obviously that's important that people know, because, like I said before, I don't think that people are aware that sensitivities are something different than allergies, that there's not that clear cause and effect. And if they're walking around in life and eating things that they're sensitive to and not knowing it, and throughout the day feeling some, you know, symptoms that they just assume are something else, they're really never going to know that they have food sensitivities, and it's something that they're doing that they can stop doing that will make them feel well. So just the fact that you're testing is great. But what I've found with my Lyme disease, that it's important to know these things, but it's also important to educate yourself. And I think that sometimes people fall into the trap where they go to a doctor or to a health coach and they're given information like, do this, and they explain why, but then the person really doesn't really look into why they're doing it. I think if they can self-educate and learn exactly what it is they're doing and why that's going to help them, that will really empower them to be able to make changes that make them feel better. I just think that it's that self-education that will allow you to continue to do these things because you know it's good for you, and not do it because you feel like you have to and it's such a drag, and then mm-hmm. maybe you're not going to stick to it because you just feel like, oh, the health coach said I had to do this, what a bummer. When right. in reality what they're doing is they're benefiting themselves and their health by making simple changes, which in the beginning, granted, it is very hard. It's hard to change the way you eat. But when you change the way you shop and the way you think, then you're into a new routine. And once you're into that new routine, it's not hard at all. It really mm-hmm. isn't. It's that transition that's hard. So if the person feels empowered to do something because they know they're doing it to make themselves feel better, I think that's really helpful.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think that really is important. I mean, we can't force anybody to do the right thing for themselves. They have to really want to do it, and I think
exactly.
you're right. Sometimes, you know, doing some self-education, and, you know, it's only the people that really want to be well that are going to do that, you know.
Exactly.
But those are definitely going to be the more compliant people out there.
Right. And another thing that I've found to be helpful for myself is to keep a symptoms journal. And this is actually something we have for free on our website that I can send you an email, a link to.
Oh, great.
But what it is basically I developed this system for myself where you write in the daily persistent symptoms that you have every day, and then you write mm-hmm. in the date, and then you rate whether or not you had the symptom at all that day, whether it was mild, whether it was moderate, or whether it was severe. And you do this through the days, every single day at the end of the day, and it's really easy because it's in a chart form. And I also at the bottom have put in what you changed in your diet, or if you found that something that you ate is triggering something. So you can
mm-hmm.
really look at it over weeks and months and see that you're maybe feeling better, because it's, like I said, it's not always apparent. And this is not a weight loss diet, although you will lose weight, as I found, but an anti-inflammation diet is not a weight loss diet. It's a help you to feel better diet. So with a weight loss diet, you can very easily see that you're making progress because the scale shows it. But if you're on a diet that you're doing to make yourself feel better and it's not something that's really obvious to you, you might not see the benefit in it. But if you're keeping track of your symptoms and you can then see it on paper, then there's that incentive, like with weight loss, where you're seeing the numbers go down. Think of if people have the incentive that they're seeing changes, whether it be, you know, something that's really obvious or not obvious, and they're looking at the symptoms journal and putting two and two together that what they're eating is making them feel better, that will help them to want to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a really good point. And people don't remember. It's funny because I work with clients who, you know, I remember what they were like when they came into me. But,
yeah.
you know, 6 months after being off their food allergens, you know, they won't have any of those things. And I'll have to say, well, remember when?
Yeah, it's really hard to
you
remember.
Know? And then they're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I did have headaches a lot, or I did have
exactly.
a lot of pain.
That's true. You seem to forget things that you know, you're like all of a sudden when something bothers you, this hurts. And then when it goes away, you forgot that you ever had that.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that as a health coach, an important thing is that you don't, when people first come in to see you, that they're not overwhelmed by you throwing a million things at them at one time. I think they're
mm-hmm.
there. These are people that are kind of came to you because they need your help, and they don't really maybe even know how much help they need. And I think that if you ease into things like, you know, not a whole bunch of you can't do this and you can't do that
mm-hmm.
to start with, because I think that if you come out of you went in there pretty desperate and you want to come out of there with hope, and I think it's really important that you are the people that they came to you, and now you're going to give them the hope and, you know, and the tools that they need to do it. And Laura and I were talking about how things have changed over in my career as far as recipe preparation and doing a recipe for people is concerned. When I first started, it was just a matter of, we need a recipe for this product, or, you know, do a recipe for this. And I did anything that I wanted. It took as long as I wanted. It was, you know, I didn't care how many ingredients were in it. It was just, if it tasted good, that was a good thing. But as more women and people became, more people were working and outside of the home, and there was less time for everything, and you really became, you know, like, if something had to give, I think what gave was the people eating more natural type foods, and so they went to convenience foods and things like that. And I don't think people really even have a clue as to how bad some of the things they eat are. You know, that the balance of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids, and when they're out of whack, and when they're eating all of these processed foods and things with hydrogenated fats and things like that. And they're doing it because they're buying things that are prepared for them ahead of time. And they think they have to do that because they think they don't have time to cook. But one of the things that we thought about in the book when we were doing it is not only should the recipe taste good, it should be able to be done in a shorter period of time. As I said before, there was never a time frame. But then it got to the point where you have to do these recipes, and they have to be 30 minutes or less because nobody's making them. They have to have only 6 or 7 ingredients, because if it's overwhelming looking, nobody's going to make it. And so it got to the point where that was the criteria to develop a recipe. Now
mm-hmm.
it's to the criteria is almost incredibly short. You know, if you can't do it in 20 minutes, people don't want to be bothered with it. So
right.
because they don't have the time when they come home, they think they have to buy convenience foods. But I think if you look through the book, there are plenty of recipes that are done in less than a half an hour. None of them are using convenience foods. Everything is fresh, and everything is pretty much good for you. So, it people should know that because they came to you for help, and then they need to change their diet and everything. It doesn't have to be something that's such an oppressing thing, because
uh-huh.
there are ways to do things that taste good and use good food, and that's where I think the book and these kind of, you know, that you look for those kind of recipes to help people, that you give handouts, that you give them something to go home with, because if you don't give them something to start with, I don't know that, you know, they'll want to continue. They have to, as Laura said, it becomes easy after a while, but when you first start, I think everybody comes in and they're like, oh, God, doctor
mm-hmm.
said I have this, now I have to do this. And they probably come to you thinking, ugh. You know, it's just not going to be fun. And
mm-hmm.
I guess it's your job to make it fun, as it was our job to try and make the food taste good. So.
Right. That's excellent. And actually, I think I shared with you already, but I'll share with everyone else on the call. It's one of the, I mean, I loved this book when I previewed it, because it was the first time I'd seen a recipe book that, well, first of all, had information in it, not just recipes. That was educational. But also because it didn't have, you know, gluten and dairy and egg and sugar, you know, in a lot of recipes. You know, I could find a lot of good, clean recipes that I could actually hand right to a client and say, hey, this would be okay for you. But the amazing thing that I've noticed since is that people are actually making the recipes. So, you know, I've handed a lot of my clients cookbooks before, but this one, I'm actually getting feedback. People are saying, oh, and I have one client who's made almost every single recipe in the book. So,
I love it.
Yeah. So it's great. I mean, I just love that it's really helping people. It's really supporting them. Okay. Well, I'm going to open up the lines. I did end up having to mute everyone because we had some background noise. So I'm going to turn the – well, actually, you can just press star 6 if you'd like to ask a question of either Gail or Laura. And when you do ask your question, just let us know who you're directing it to so they'll know who should answer. Okay? So go ahead and just press star 6 if you'd like to ask a question. Hi, Irma.
Hi, Kelly. First of all, thank you, Kelly, for arranging this. It's wonderful when like-minded people come together and the thought of a mother and daughter coming together, collaboration, just warms my heart. I did go to Amazon to take a look at the book. It looks incredibly beautiful, almost like a cooker's Bible because it looks so beautifully presented. I had a question for Gail.
Yes.
I noticed that there was cookware that you had recommended, and I'm just wondering if in there you talk about the, I don't know if it's called analyze, the lining, the pots and pans that are lined versus enamel pans. Just wondering what your thought was on that. And also, I'm happy to hear that you have recipes on almond milk because that is one of the easiest things to make.
Uh-huh.
But for those that don't, do you support buying any of the milks in the Tetra Paks, the packs that are in the health food stores?
Laura, I think Laura has said that some of them have some ingredients that you might not want. I think the most important thing is to read the labels to see what you're getting. I mean, you don't want sugar added. So I think that there is Silk has one now that has, there are like four of them. I was looking at it. There's not just some has sugar because I saw there was a difference in the number of calories. So I think I would say that probably the best thing for you to do because it's all totally natural is if you make it yourself. But if you're not, if you're in the health food store, I think it's important to read the label and pick the one that's best, you know, that would be best for you. I think that there are, you know, as I said, there's a variety of different things out there. So, you know, I would say that I would suggest first, I would think the best thing to do would be make it, and it's not really hard. But if it's something, I think that a lot of people, when they first get the book, we found this and we have this in our on the website. I mean, on our newsletter. People, you know, because it's you were saying, oh, it's a diet. I have to go on a diet. It's a this. It's a that. You know, it's too much for me. What we had one of Laura's coworkers had bought this book, and she was not really ready to go on the diet. So what she did was she started making things from different phases of the thing of the book to get herself acquainted with it, and she was finding recipes that she liked, and she said that now she knows that when she does go on the diet that she has things that she's going to have later on that she likes, that it's not so oppressive, that there are things that are easy to make, and so she's not as overwhelmed as she was at the very beginning. I thought that was really interesting because I think that, you know, if you buy something and you look at it and you keep putting it off saying, oh, I'll do that tomorrow. But if you start out and you look at the recipes and you find a few things you like, then as with any kind of a diet, even a diet to lose weight, when you're ready, you're ready. And so then she will not. And we found people saying that they're not, you know, just as Laura said, they're not really overwhelmed by it anymore. They're doing it and they're liking it.
Mm-hmm.
And to your question right. About cookware, I happen to be one of my things I've done all my life is test cookware. And I think you're talking about things with coating, with nonstick coatings, are you?
Yes, I am.
Okay. There's a school of thought that says that it's very bad for you. There's a school of thoughts that says there's absolutely no proof in that. I work for people that do make cookware that is both coated and non-coated. I myself use both coated and non-coated. They swear and they say that there's nothing at all true about the coatings being causing any kind of problems. And in the years that since I've been doing this, when it first came out, man, was that stuff terrible. It would flake. It would be in your food. I mean, it would be terrible. Now there are all sorts of new coatings that are very, very dense, very hard, and they don't flake. In fact, I'm doing a test right now. All-clad is one of my clients, and they have both non-coated and coated cookware. One of the things I'm doing is what they've done is they are going to probably offer a service to people when the cookware starts to look beat. And their cookware does not peel, but if you cut in it, it will get marks in it. So what they're going to do is they're going to take the cookware back. They're going to remove the coating. They send it to a coating manufacturer who will redo it, and the cookware will look perfectly new. I'm working on one pan right now that's I've been using for 5 months. It has not deteriorated in any way at all. I've used it about 65 hours so far. What I do is I cook in it, and then I keep track, and then I clean it, and I clean the exterior and the interior, and I find no problem whatsoever. But if you do feel that way, and if you are not sure that scientifically it's true that there's no problem, I feel that stainless cookware most of the things I test are stainless with a coat, with an interior, with a tri-ply where there'll be copper, which is a very good conductor because stainless is a very poor conductor of heat. But aluminum and copper are not, they're in the interior. They're not on the surface. With the surface is 1810 or 1812, stainless steel, which is very high grade, which does not, no aluminum leaching out, nothing like that. So that cookware is very good. And there's also the enameled cookware, which would be cast iron or cast aluminum, which is covered with enamel. I've tested several of those products. I'm testing one right now, as a matter of fact. And those are very safe. The enamel coatings are very hard. They're very safe. They're very good. The quality of the food you cook in it is excellent because they're cast iron or cast aluminum. They're heavy. They have very good conductors of heat, and the enamel is very safe. So and you don't really need to use a whole lot of fat in any of this kind of cooking. You can really pretty much cook fat free. So that's what I know. And if that didn't answer your question, please ask me if there's something else.
Well, that answered my question. Unfortunately, I had to step away because there was somebody pounding at my door, so I apologize if you said, does that answer your question, Irma, and I wasn't here. But I heard all about the cooking, and thank you. I was thinking more, I guess I have a basic mistrust for any industry that's coating our pans where they told us before it was safe,
right.
And then now
right.
All of a sudden, saying, well,
right.
Okay. And that's why I feel much more comfortable with the the
sure.
cast iron coated.
Right, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, quality of cooking wise, I think that they're you can do just as well without using a coated pan. I like them. I use them. I do believe that the coatings now are way, way better than they were. And I just talked to my client about that recently. I said, "What are you finding?" And they're saying, we're finding that that our coating is safe, but of course they're selling their pans. So if you feel that that's a problem, I don't think there's any problem saying that, and I don't think there's any problem not using it, because I think you can get just as good quality of the food that you cook in a pan that is not coated, with just a little small amount of either cooking spray or a small amount of coating of oil or a little olive oil, which obviously we know is good for you. So I have no problem at all not using nonstick, and as I said, I do use it, but if you think that it's not good, I would say good for you. And, if you think that it's something that your people shouldn't be using, I say, then you tell them that.
Was there any particular brand of the cast iron coated enamel that you would recommend?
No, actually, I have several. I have Le Creuset, which is what I'm testing against. I have a client that's coming out with come out with a lighter weight cast iron enamel coated pan, because as you know, they're really, really heavy. And I found my testing, which was quite interesting, that the weight didn't really seem to make that much difference. That it did not need to weigh 11 pounds. If it weighed 6.5 pounds, which is what this pan did weigh, I got the same cooking results. So I think they're all good. I mean, you know, Le Creuset is very good. And the products that I've tested against are all seem to be just about as good. So I don't think it's necessary to spend a fortune. Le Creuset is very expensive. I think some of the less expensive ones seem to be working as well, and I would just watch to make sure that that when you bought it, if you see any kind of cracking or crazing or anything like that, any kind of chipping of the enamel, that it should not chip. But if it would chip, I would definitely get in touch. They have to be guaranteed. That's the only thing I would worry about. If you bought a less expensive one, if the quality was not as good when they coated it and the enamel would chip. But no, I don't see any reason to spend a fortune if you can get one, you know, at a medium price. I know that Emeraldware is part of Allclad, and I worked. I was a food stylist for 5 or 6 years doing all of Emerald stuff. And they have cast iron with an enamel coating, and it is very good. And I don't think it's that expensive, so I would say that that's a good brand.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Excellent. Anybody else have any questions for Gail or Laura?
Really looking forward to looking at this. In particular, I think because I have a husband who loves pancakes and things of this nature, and he's never been tested, and I don't really know, but I'm always trying to figure out a way to get the things he likes into his diet without the things I don't want in his diet.
Right.
So I'm quite thrilled because it's a constant battle with the pancake waffle conversation.
Okay, good.
Anything else? Anybody have questions about, you know, making things with multiple allergies or, you know, what your clients are finding most challenging in dealing with their food sensitivities? Anything like that? Or anybody have the book and want to just give some feedback? I know a couple of you have it. So,
can I just ask one question, Kelly? It's Lisa.
Sure.
It's about ghee, using ghee, which is, I understand, non-dairy.
Mm-hmm.
Have you used, are you using any of that in your cooking?
Yes, we have ghee.
Oh, go ahead. I didn't know who you were asking, Lisa, so
I'm
going to let
Laura and Gail.
Okay.
Laura, you can answer that. Okay. Yes, we use ghee in a good number of the recipes. We, with the icons on the top, we don't say that it's dairy-free, although ghee, in the process of making it what it is, it's clarified butter, so you're in the process getting rid of the milk solids. So it then does become dairy-free, but we asked Dr. Singleton that question because we didn't want to advertise it as dairy-free. Obviously, it's coming from dairy products. But he said that it is fine for people with dairy sensitivities. We actually have a recipe in the book on how to make the ghee, or you can buy it just at the store. It's clarified butter. It's really quite expensive. So what we decided was that it made more sense just to give the recipe on how to make it. You're able to get all of the milk solids and fats out, so then it is okay for a person with a dairy sensitivity to eat.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And we, in those recipes that we do use the ghee, just if somebody doesn't want to do it, usually get an alternative, olive oil or different something else that you could use in its place. So, but yeah, that was, ghee was something that we had thought about.
This is Irma. I just wanted to comment on the journal that was created. Laura, did you create that?
I did, yes.
It's so great.
Oh, thank you. You found it. Great. Thank you.
I did. It was easily accessible on the website. Do you have people, I don't know if you work with clients in this way, that people are using your food recipes and the journal and they email it back and forth, or is it just something that you print out and keep at home?
I don't know if any of our readers have taken advantage of it. I know that at my support group, I tell people who have the book that they should keep track, and I keep track of my own, and the doctors really like that when you're able to bring it in and show them the progress of your symptoms. But I really haven't gotten much feedback on it. I hope people are using it because I really do think that it's beneficial.
Yeah, really. Fabulous. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And we do a lot, just so that you guys know, in terms of working with our clients, a lot of us will have them do food journals.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
This might be a nice way to tie that together,
Right.
And we do generally ask them to list any symptoms and that sort of thing. But I'm going to take a look at it, too.
It's really good. Yeah, I try to make it as easy as possible, because I know with food journals, I usually just type mine because handwriting is really, terrible handwriting. It just seems like it's too overwhelming and I don't remember to do it. But with the journal that I made, it's basically filling in numbers, and it takes 2 minutes at night before you go to sleep. So anything to make it a little bit easier for people. I think everyone wants convenience, and that's why I did it like that.
And it's also interesting, the topics that you chose to write, burning in feet. Who would ever think? Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Very.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
that's a typical symptom of one of the tick-borne illnesses called Bartonella, so that's where that came from. Some of those were my symptoms. Some of those are typical Lyme or co-infection symptoms that I put on there, because I did an example page just so everyone knows that I put an example on there so people understand how to use the journal.
You have a total at the end of each day, right? You just want to see collectively going down. Headaches was a 2 for a long time, and light sensitivity has been a 3. The consistency or the inconsistency or the changes, you just want to, I'm asking, be able to see in the columns as you look at them versus the total.
Right, exactly. So when you go to the doctor every 2 months, they could say, how are your symptoms? It's easy for you to now say, oh, wow, well, I used to have headaches, 3/4 of the days, and now I'm only having headaches 1/2 of the days. So it's easy to assess that you've made a change, or maybe your headaches are not severe anymore. They're more in the moderate or mild.
Well, congratulations on no more joint pain.
That's actually not the numbers are there aren't mine. Just the symptoms.
Oh, okay,
I
sorry.
Have. Yeah, no. Luckily for me, I don't have any joint pain. That's not one of my symptoms. But that is a very typical Lyme symptom that I'm very thankful not to have.
Well, Gail, Laura, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I want to thank everyone else for being on the call. And I'll send out that info after the call to everyone, and just thanks again.
Okay,
yeah, thank you.
You,
and if anybody has any other questions you think of, feel free to email us, talk to us on Facebook or whatever way you want.
Yep, we're always happy
Great.
To answer questions, so be in touch.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank
Bye,
you.
Ladies.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, take care. Bye.